Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schloem. Hawaii's Kilauea is the world's most active volcano. Its current series of eruptions began in early May. The eruptions have covered a relatively small area of the Big Island's landmass as fissures dramatically fountain lava into spectacular flows to the sea. As bad as things are for the residents of Leilani Estates who have lost homes to the lava, the Kona coast on the other side of the island, where most of the tourist resorts are located, is basically unaffected. Yet mainland tourists have been canceling trips to the island, disrupting the tourist-based economy. Meanwhile, in Guatemala, the Volcán del Fuego, which translates literally into Mountain of Fire, had some explosive eruptions in May which killed dozens of local residents, a much more calamitous situation. So to sort all this out, we decided to turn to one of our favorite volcano experts. Eric Clemente is Associate Professor and Chair of Geosciences at Denison University in Ohio. Eric is a volcanologist and petrologist, meaning he studies the magmas beneath the surface in order to understand the types of eruptions they can produce. Eric's blog, Rocky Planet, on Discover Magazine's website, deals with a variety of earth science topics, but definitely focuses on volcanoes in the news. Eric joined us from his Ohio home via Skype. Eric, welcome once again to Blue Dot. And Eric, give us your bona fides again. What exactly is your title?
I guess the best way, that's a good question. It can go in a lot of directions. Volcanologist is probably the best term for what I do, although I tend to study the things that are going on underground more than what's going above ground in terms of my research. So one could also call that being a petrologist, although volcanologist is a little more what people can grab onto.
Yeah, it's got the cachet. And your academic affiliation again?
Denison University.
Yeah. Where is that?
It is in the middle of Ohio, and almost smack in the middle. Columbus is, I guess, smack in the middle, and we're about 20 miles to the east of Columbus.
A lot of volcanic activity around there, is there?
Not particularly. I like to joke with my students that we're only, 5 kilometers from igneous rock, but you have to go straight down to get there. But it's all old basement rocks that are the igneous ones around here that don't really show their face through much of Ohio.
And when did you first get interested in volcanoes to the extent that you decided this is what I want to study and this is what I want to do?
Yeah, that's a tough one because it was not a direct route in any way, shape, or form. I can sort of maybe point back to the fact that, my mother is from Colombia and she grew up in Pereira, which is near Nevada del Ruiz. So when I was young, I spent time down there and saw some of the impacts of the big, it wasn't a big eruption, but the big mud flow related to Ruiz that killed, over 20,000 people. So that made an impression, but it didn't really set me on that track. And by the time I was in college, I changed my major like 4 times before reaching geology. And then even my first job after I got out of college had nothing to do with geology. It was a history job. But then I decided I wasn't cut out to work in the business world and liked teaching. So that's the direction I wanted to go. And even then I kind of decided between, do I want to study volcanoes or glaciers? Because I liked them both. And finally ended up on volcanoes and luckily ended up with an amazing project with Anita Grunder at Oregon State looking at volcanoes in Chile. And it's kind of been all volcanoes ever since.
And those are the Andes, of course. Were there any glaciers on those volcanoes?
Nothing. At least the volcanoes that I worked on in Chile were glacier-free. They're up in the northern part of Chile. And there were the signs of former glaciers, but nothing active up there where I was, glacially at least.
I was going to say, Mount Rainier would have to be just like the perfect combination for you.
Well, so the work that I currently do right now at Hood in Oregon, there's glaciers on Hood, and I've been up to one of the glaciers on there, but Rainier again would be another fun place to do some work on.
Well, our goal today is to kind of do a volcanology 101 and educate all of us about the inner workings of volcanoes, the types of eruptions they have, and why. So let's start out with, you talked about petrology and the inner workings of the Earth. Let's start out with magmas. My understanding is that there's two basic kinds, what's called a mafic magmas and felsic magmas. Give us a simple explanation of the difference between the two.
So, yeah, I mean, those are definitely the end members. It's a whole spectrum, and they're classified. You can classify them in a couple of ways. One is just to look at how much silica is in it. And silica is silicon and oxygen, so SiO2. So mafic magma, things like basalt, don't have, relatively speaking, a lot of silica. Maybe high 40s, low 50% of the magma is silica. And then you get up to the felsic rocks or felsic magma like rhyolite. That's up over 70%. Silica. And then there's a whole bunch of other elements that are commonly found in all magmas, iron, calcium, potassium, calcium. Did I say calcium?
You did.
Oh, I did. Okay. So I said them twice. I'm trying to think through them off the top of my head. But anyway, there's a whole bunch of different elements that you commonly find, and they vary according to that spectrum as well. So mafic magmas have a lot of calcium and magnesium. Felsic magmas have a lot of sodium and potassium. So they end up having different minerals form in them. So the other way we classify them is looking at the minerals. So in for a basalt, you look at a basalt, you get these green minerals that are olivine and darker green minerals that are pyroxene. And then you look at a rhyolite, and you tend to find things like clear quartz crystals or sanidine crystals or dark specks of biotite mica. And then in between the two, there are things like andesite, which is called an intermediate magma that's kind of in between compositionally. And you find a little bit of the different minerals from both types. And it's all a process that the different magmas that you have can be created either by cooling a basalt and crystallizing a bunch of stuff out of it, or mixing different batches of magma to make something that's in between, things like that.
Well, okay, that makes me think of a question. What came first, the Andes or the andesite? Like, where does the name come from?
The andesite was named after the Andes, to my knowledge. So the Andes, the name there has been around longer. But yeah, the Andes are the type locality for our classic andesites. So where you have volcanoes forming on continents due to subduction, where one plate is diving underneath another, you tend to get things like andesites that we see in the Andes or in the Cascades or places like that.
So like for our listeners in Northern California, that's what Mount Shasta is essentially made of.
There's a lot of andesite there, probably. I think there's some more silicic stuff as well. Lassen definitely has a lot more variety. They have dacite, which is felsic rock, and some rhyolites where you have the big caldera eruption. The Rocklin caldera was more of a rhyolite from Lassen. So yeah, there's a variety of rocks that you, or lava stuff that's being erupted from these volcanoes, but they tend to be higher silica when they're erupting at a continent and lower silica at places like Hawaii out in the middle of a ocean basin.
And so the basalts, the black lava rock that we see, a lot of people put them in their yards as a like ornamental rock, especially in Northern California. Those have more metal in them, the more iron, so they tend to be denser, heavier. And these felsic rocks like andesite and the dacites, those rhyolites, those are much lighter rocks, right? So like if I pick up a piece of each that's the same size, that basalt's going to be heavier.
Yeah, you'll notice a difference. They're not strongly different, but there's definitely a difference, and that does come back to the different sorts of elements that you tend to find more so in a mafic magma than you find in a felsic magma.
Okay, well, let's talk about the types of volcanoes that these erupt. So let's start with Hawaii, because it's been so much in the news. those volcanic islands, the Hawaiian islands, those are called shield volcanoes, right?
Yep. So the shield volcanoes that you see in Hawaii and in other places, you actually have some shield volcanoes in the Cascades, even up in Oregon. They're being formed because basalt, one of the compositional tricks that happens is that the mafic magmas, the low silica magmas, tend to be lower viscosity. So they are more runny. And when they erupt, you get lava flows that spread out easily, relatively speaking. And you get these large, broad shapes that when you look down at them from above, they kind of look like a warrior shield. And those are the sorts of things you see in Hawaii, that your volcanoes tend to erupt lots of basalt that is much runnier to make these shields, rather than what we think of maybe for Shasta or Lassen, where you get stickier lavas that are more felsic, because the higher the silica, the stickier that lava gets. So you get a different shape of volcano.
So those lavas build more of a cone, whereas the shields have a much broader, gentle slopes that cover a larger area. Would that be a fair way of characterizing it?
Yeah, and if you're standing at, I remember just this past March when I was in Hawaii, you can stand on one part of Kilauea and look out at Mauna Loa, which is another one of these shield volcanoes. And you could almost, you know, it is so broad and low sloped that at times you'd be hard pressed to think that there is a peak on it at all, because it's just this a very shallow few degree slope to the sides. Unlike you think of, again, Shasta, where you get these really steep sided cones. That Shasta is a really big volcano of its type, a composite volcano or a stratovolcano, but it's tiny compared to how big something like Mauna Loa is, because it's so immensely broad and comparatively speaking. So Mauna Loa is 13,000, I think around 13,000 feet tall, but it also extends 10,000 feet down underneath the ocean and covers an area that's close to, you know, maybe a half or three quarters of the size of the whole Big Island. So it's a whole different scale of volcano.
Well, speaking of different scales, my understanding is the largest shield volcano isn't even on this planet.
Yeah, so if we're talking shield volcanoes off this planet, you head over to Mars and you get Olympus Mons, which is about the size of the state of Arizona. And it, you know, one of the ways that you can kind of think about it is that if you took all of the lavas erupted from the Hawaiian island chain and the seamount chain that goes all the way almost up to Kamchatka and the Aleutians, it would equal about the same as the size of Olympus Mons on Mars. So it's one of these signs that maybe Mars doesn't have much in the way of active tectonics, and never really has, but it is just an immensely huge volcano relative to anything on Earth.
Yeah, and like you said before, you know, the slopes are so gentle. I remember talking to a volcanologist once who was telling me about, you know, if you were on Olympus Mons, you'd just be walking up this gentle slope forever, it would seem like, and then suddenly, you know, at some point, you'd be like, oh, I'm at the top. It wouldn't be like you said, climbing a tall mountain where you're trudging up and up and up.
Yep, you know, it's just a few degrees slope being built by these lava flows. It's going to be a little, you know, comparative volcanology when you look at different planets. Other things get involved, like the gravity of each planet will dictate a little bit about how lava flows are going to behave. Mm-hmm. So it's the slopes won't exactly be the same as what we find on Earth, but yeah, it's going to be flat and broad, and you'd most likely not really think you're climbing up a mountain for most of the time.
You're listening to Blue Dot on NSPR. I'm Dave Shlom. We're going to take a short break, but when we come back, we'll return to our look at volcanoes and eruptions with Denison University Geosciences Professor Eric Clementi. We'll be right back. And we're back. Let's return to our conversation with Denison University professor and volcanologist Eric Clementi. Well, back to Hawaii and Kilauea, I've noticed these two types of lava flows there. The initial lava flows coming out of those fissure eruptions were like these craggy, blocky looking things. And then it got more fluid and flowing. And they have these wonderful Hawaiian names. I was wondering if you could share those with us.
Yeah, so the blocky ones are what they call a'a, and then the ones that are more flowing and ropey are the pahoehoe. And, you know, what they say is that the a'a got its name from walking over the lava flows with bare feet. That's what you'd be saying. Yeah, because it's all so rubbly. And then the pahoehoe is a much smoother surface, and then the tops of those flows cool a little bit faster than the interior, and they kind of get, you know, for lack of a better term, they kind of have a leathery top to them, so they can still deform. And when they flow, the top of that flow will kind of stack up and pile up, and you get these ropey textures from the stacked up surface of the lava flow. So that's how you can kind of tell them apart. An a'a is going to be big chunks of rough rubble that are all piled up along the flow. It's still flowing. It's flowing more like maybe a tractor where the top part rolls down and then the back part rolls over the front, as opposed to a pahoehoe flow that really does look like a river of lava. And that difference is just caused mostly by things like a flow is going to be a little bit more viscous, a little bit stickier, and it might be because it has a few more crystals have formed in it, or it's got a little bit less gas in it, or it might be a little bit cooler so that it'll be stickier and you get that difference of flow. And pahoehoe flows can become a flows as they get further away from where they're erupted. So that's almost exactly the same in terms of their composition. There just might be little variations that cause the different types of flow.
And could you just give us kind of an overview of what's been going on in Kilauea the last couple of weeks? Where do we stand now with the eruptions? What do you observe that's been happening, and what are some of the interesting things?
Well, right now it seems like this eruption, I think we're in day 42 of it right now, and it is set a fairly, at least over the last few weeks, it has set a very stable, it's in a stable configuration, it seems, where down at Leilani Estates, there is mostly a single fissure that's producing most of the lava, fissure 8, where you have these lava fountains that are shooting lava out of the ground up to maybe a couple hundred feet. And then you have a lava flow that's coming from a cone that's building there. It's called a spatter cone. And those are the lavas that are making it all the way down to the ocean and had filled in Kapoa Bay a few weeks ago. And that eruption doesn't seem, there's no signs that it's going to cease anytime soon. Some of the other fissures show signs that they could reactivate. But right now it seems like we've reached a pretty stable configuration with that one fissure being the place where most of the eruption is happening. And that's actually pretty typical for this sort of Hawaiian style eruption, where all of the activity will sort of end up coalescing and centralizing to one place after a whole bunch of fissures were active. Back up at the summit, we're still getting explosions every once in a while. But you can look at some satellite images they've taken of the summit, and a whole area around the crater where the lava lake used to be is just slumping down into the volcano. So the crater has gotten a lot bigger up at the summit, as all of the magma that might have been up there that was supporting the surface of the volcano has drained out towards the rift. And the summit is kind of collapsing in on itself to some degree. So that seems to be, again, a pattern that's been going about the same for the last few weeks, where they'd have earthquakes that build up for a while and then an explosion, and then the earthquakes die back down again. And the pattern repeats itself as the summit's sort of settling into a new normal, I think.
And how does this eruptive cycle compare to what we know of Kilauea's past?
I think what we're seeing is things that have happened in the volcano's past. So this is not anything startlingly new. It hasn't happened at Kilauea like this for probably, you know, at least up at the summit, we haven't had a long period, a month or more of explosions since the 1920s. These fissure eruptions, like is going on down at the Lower East Rift at Leilani Estates, is something that hasn't happened since the middle of the middle of the 20th century. But it is, this is different than what had been happening for the past 35 years, which had been the lava lake at Pu'uo'o, and for the last 10 years, the lava lake at the summit. And both of those features, I think, are gone probably for quite a long time. Pu'uo'o seems to have completely shut off. And the summit lava lake, the crater that it's sat in, is just much larger than it used to be. So it'd be a lot harder to put a lava lake in there again. So I think we've seen Kilauea kind of reestablishing establishing a new normal, and as opposed to what had been happening for the past 35 years, at least.
And I noticed one thing that tends to irritate you in particular and volcanologists is this constant worry on social media about these eruptions triggering a tsunami. Could you just briefly address that?
Yeah. So the idea here is that at other volcanoes like Kilauea, a shield volcano from a hotspot in the middle of the ocean, they have the tendency occasionally to have parts of the side of the volcano collapse just gravitationally. And that could trigger a tsunami. So the example is that people have studied volcanoes in the Canary Islands, and they have found that some of those volcanoes have had big landslides where part of the volcano slides off into the ocean and has potentially caused tsunamis in the Atlantic. So the worry is, of course, that could be that could happen at Kilauea. Although for all of these events, there's nothing that directly indicates that an eruption is what's causing the landslide to happen that causes a potential tsunami. So although the volcano is really active, there's nothing in particular that would say that this is going to trigger a tsunami because of the fact that this eruption is happening. So in fact, most of the ones are probably happen well after the volcano is done erupting and might even be heading towards being extinct, as you just kind of weather the sides of the volcano away through all that wave action and then have that side of the volcano go collapsing off into the ocean.
And most tsunamis, like the ones we observed in 2011 with the Japan earthquake, those are caused by deep undersea, massive megathrust earthquakes at subduction zones, which is a totally different phenomenon, right?
Yeah. So the big tsunami, the Tohoku in Japan, and then the Boxing Day in 2004 in Indonesia, were all caused by earthquakes that happened that caused the sea floor to snap upwards during the earthquake in that subduction zone setting. And that's going to generate a lot larger of a tsunami than a landslide might from a collapsing volcano in whatever, Hawaii or the Canary Islands. But those, again, those collapses at these volcanoes are very, very infrequent, especially to be large enough to generate any sort of significant tsunami wave.
So for people worried about Hawaii, a tsunami threat from this volcanic eruption series should be pretty low down there on the priority list of worries.
Yeah, I mean, and in fact, this eruption at Kilauea, there aren't a lot of hazards that people need to be concerned about unless their house is in the area that these lava flows are happening. So, you know, there's the perception that it would be bad. I've gotten a number of emails, people asking, should I go to Hawaii, or I have relatives in other parts of, in other islands in Hawaii, and how is it going to impact it? And it's really, this is a tiny little fraction of the whole big island that this is happening on. So I think it is clearly a disaster for the people who have lost their homes in Leilani Estates and vacation land and in those areas, and can be a threat if there's explosions that carry ash and carry sulfur dioxide and things like that around the island, but it's by no means something that's causing the whole island to have to shut itself down in any way.
Okay, Eric, let's talk about this notion of volcanic activity around the Pacific, the so-called Pacific Ring of Fire. I saw a geologist saying that that's not even a scientific term, it's just a literary one. Is that an accurate way of talking about the so-called Pacific Ring of Fire? Is it just a literary term?
More or less. And, you know, it could very well, you could have seen the article that I wrote that said pretty much that. The Ring of Fire is one of these terms that it is evocative, and it doesn't particularly describe a geologic event or geologic processes that are linked, other than the fact that we have a lot of volcanoes and earthquakes that happen along the edge of the Pacific, because the Pacific Basin is closing ever so slowly as the continents move. But activity that happens in Japan is in no way directly impacting something that's happening in, let's say, you know, Guatemala or Mexico or something like that. So the Ring of Fire, its definition is problematic even at that, because it's supposed to talk about volcanoes that are along the Pacific Rim, yet Indonesia gets included in that. And Indonesia is, of course, more on the Indian Ocean than the Pacific Ocean. So I feel like it is used as a bit of a boilerplate on a lot of volcanic articles about volcanism, but it really doesn't tell us much. And it tends to get people thinking that these events are all connected directly, that an earthquake is going to trigger an eruption someplace along the Ring of Fire or vice versa, or one eruption will get another volcano going someplace else. And that's just not the case.
And with us, let's use the Pacific Ring of Fire just as that literary device. Hawaii is in the center of the Pacific. It's not part of the so-called Ring of Fire. Could you explain to us why Hawaii is so different from the volcanoes, say, in Japan or Guatemala or the Pacific Northwest?
Yeah, so all those places on the edges of the Pacific, most of them are being formed by subduction. So you have a piece of oceanic plate diving it down underneath another plate. It might be another oceanic plate, or it might be like a continent. So in North America, the Cascades, you have the Juan de Fuca plate off the coast that's diving down underneath North America, and that's what's causing volcanoes to form there. The Hawaiian islands are being formed by a hotspot. So you have hot material coming up through the mantle, rising because it's hot, and melting along the way and more or less burning a hole through the Pacific plate. So it's almost like if you were to hold a lighter underneath a piece of paper, you'd burn a hole through that. And that's what's happening as this hot material reaches the Pacific plate and all that magma is formed. It works its way to the surface and forms these volcanoes. So it's not forming because of subduction, but rather from a hot spot instead.
And let's turn our attention now to another volcano that's been in the news, Volcán del Fuego in Guatemala. Tell us about what's going on there.
So Fuego, it's one of the most active volcanoes in Guatemala to begin with. And it has a history of producing a number of different types of eruptions. So sometimes it does have lava flows. So it can erupt magma that can flow rather than form an explosive eruption. Sometimes it has what they call Strombolian eruptions that have lava fountains associated with them that are more explosive. And then sometimes it can produce these bigger explosive eruptions that are Plinian or subplinian styles of eruptions that build the clouds that you kind of think of for a volcano that's spread out and look like an umbrella.
This is Blue Dot. I'm Dave Shlom. Thanks for listening to our conversation with Eric Clemente as we talk about volcanic eruptions. We're going to take a short break, but stay with us. And we're back. Let's continue with our look at volcanic eruptions with Denison University Geosciences Professor Eric Clemente on Blue Dot. So, Eric, I'd like to get an update from you because we talked to you last week and we're talking to you again this week about Hawaii. Can you just give us an update on what's going on with Kilauea?
Well, it seems like the eruption just keeps on keeping on. The last update that the USGS put out on the eruption seemed to suggest that the explosions at the summit are likely not going to get any worse than they have been. So they're not expecting a big explosion up there anymore, but we might get smaller ones from now and then. But then otherwise, lava flows just keep on issuing out of that fissure 8. And there's nothing in particular that suggests that it's going to stop anytime soon. The flows seem to be potentially hotter and moving faster, which might mean it's tapping magma that's a little newer to the system, but really the change is very subtle, if anything. So yeah, it's keeping on erupting like it has been.
Can you put into context for us, because Hawaii, the big island, is a very large island, and there's been a pretty big hit to tourism, as I understand it, for all of the islands, from people, you know, worrying about the volcano. Put into perspective for us, the area affected compared to the rest of the big island is relatively small, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it turns out that it works out to be about 0.1% of the island. So the big island is somewhere around 10,000 square kilometers. And the lava flow is about 9.5 or 10 square kilometers. So it's very little of the island has been directly impacted. And then the parts that are being sort of indirectly impacted by things like the volcanic fogs and sulfur dioxide and ash are still confined to the areas relatively close to the volcano. So, you know, for the most of the big island, you wouldn't even know it was happening. Especially for the rest of the islands, you doubly don't know it's happening. So there's been a lot of the way it's been portrayed seems like it's affecting a lot more of the island than it actually is.
Yeah, so if you've got a trip planned to Maui or Oahu, or even, you know, the touristy side of the Kona coast of the big island, this has no effect on your vacation plan, so just go.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I've had a number of people email me about that, and I've been telling them, yeah, as long as you listen to what the officials are saying and don't venture too close into the active eruption. I know that they had to arrest some people who were trying to take selfies in front of the lava. But as long as you stay away from those areas, most of the big island is perfectly safe to visit.
Yeah. And most, as I understand, most of the touristy part of the island, the resort part, I should say, is not anywhere near Leilani Estates.
Yep. So you'd have to be, even coming from Hilo or Kona, you're a ways. Kona's a good couple hours away from Kilauea. And, you know, even parts of the national park are open in a limited capacity. So it really isn't something that has shut down all the activity on the island.
All right. Well, doing what I can to help out my friends in Hawaii who depend on your tourism dollars. So you should go. There's nothing to be afraid of. But if, you know, for the people who are homeowners in that area, it's been quite, you know, devastating. You mentioned VOG, and I've heard these terms, VOG and LAZE. Could you just describe what those things are?
Yeah, so the first one, VOG, is short for sort of volcanic fog. And most of these eruptions at Kilauea, they release a lot of sulfur dioxide because they have all this sulfur dioxide that's dissolved in the magma itself, and then it comes out of solution when that lava reaches the surface or gets close to the surface, kind of like, you know, you pop a soda bottle and you get bubbles and they rise up to the surface and leave the soda. This sulfur dioxide is kind of doing the same thing. But then when it reacts with moisture in the atmosphere, it turns into sulfuric acid droplets. And that's the stuff that if you breathe it in, it can hurt your lungs, and plants don't like it particularly much. You have to be really overwhelmed by it or already have some sort of respiratory problems to likely have it be a fatal
sort of incident when you encounter Vog, but you definitely don't want to linger. That's why you always see pictures of the scientists working around there wearing face masks to prevent breathing in these droplets. And, you know, that's part of the reason why even before any of these eruptions, they had parts of the road around the caldera at the summit closed, because it would just get so much sulfur dioxide being blown that way from the lava lake that used to be up at the summit. So that's the Vog. The Lays is volcanic haze, and it's coming from lava interacting with seawater and producing, you get this, it looks, you look at the pictures and it looks like just a big steam plume. And most of it is steam, but some of it is little glass shards, so volcanic ash being produced as the lava fractures when it hits the cold ocean water. And then you get these reactions between the ocean water and the lava, and you release things like hydrochloric acid, because you have all the chlorine in the salt water. So you have these chemical reactions that happen. So you have a mist made of glass shards and hydrochloric acid, and that, again, is not something you want to be breathing in as well.
Yeah, that sounds lovely. Lays sounds like something you should definitely avoid.
Yes, yeah. I mean, these ocean entries are dangerous places. They, not only do you have the Lays, but you also have the fact that they're very unstable. So it's pretty common to see these lava benches that form collapse because they're not really well supported. So if you go out there and you want to see the lava flow and you try to walk out to the shore, you might end up being part of one of these collapses of a lava bench. So they always say to, you know, the survey and Hawaiian officials are telling people, you know, you stay away from the ocean entries. They might be really spectacular to see, but they can be really hazardous for on a number of fronts.
Well, let's go to the other part of the Pacific, from the central to the eastern Pacific, and Guatemala specifically. Tell us about Volcán del Fuego and the eruptions that have been going on there.
So Fuego is a different type of volcano than Kilauea. And Fuego is being formed by, you know, one plate diving down underneath another plate there in Guatemala, and you produce magma that rises up through the crust and gets to be higher silica, so stickier magma, and you get volcanoes that have steep sides. And instead of having all lava flows, like Kilauea is almost entirely made of lava flows, Fuego is a mix. It has some lava flow sometimes, but then it also has these explosive eruptions that produce a lot of ash. They have domes that form, domes of lava that form at the summit. And those domes can collapse, or they can clog the vent up at the top, and they get sort of blasted out of the way when pressure begins to build. And it sends these flows of hot ash and volcanic debris down the side of the volcano at 100, 200 kilometers per hour, and at 500, 600, 700 degrees C, that blast their way down the side of the volcano, kind of knocking everything out of its way and burning up anything that's burnable along the way. So they move a lot faster than even the fastest lava flows. You know, they've clocked a few of the lava flows at Kilauea, moving at something in the vicinity of 20, 25 kilometers per hour. Pyroclastic flows, like I'm talking about, are moving at hundreds of kilometers per hour. So there in Guatemala, at Fuego, people died because they just didn't have time to get out of the way of these big ash flows, pyroclastic flows that were coming down the side of the volcano.
So these subduction-type volcanoes that we find around the rim of the Pacific, like we have in the Pacific Northwest from Northern California up to the Canadian border, the Cascades, those are very violent volcanoes, like as we saw with Mount St. Helens in 1980.
Yeah, they can be. They don't have to be, but they can be. So you have eruptions that they tend to be more explosive, but they can also produce lava flows as well. You know, even the small eruption at Lassen at the start of the 20th century, that was actually a fairly small eruption. Not a lot of stuff came out, but it had a big impact because it was explosive and produced these pyroclastic flows and also produced volcanic mud flows, lahars, that went down river channels. So these stratovolcanoes or composite volcanoes can be have a larger impact for a smaller volume of stuff erupted just because they can be explosive that way.
And pyroclastic flows are also famously what wiped out Pompeii in 79 AD, right?
Yeah, so Vesuvius, again, another one of these volcanoes that's built out of layers of lava flows and ash and other volcanic debris that we call tephra. And it erupted explosively and sent, first it sent a whole pile of ash that fell on the city. And then it sent these pyroclastic flows down through the city that trapped anyone who was left in the city, wherever they stood.
And you would have no chance if you were in the path of a pyroclastic flow. As I recall, there was a famous couple that used to photograph volcanoes. I remember a National Geographic special I saw about them, the Crafts. They were killed in one of those types of events in Japan, I believe.
Yeah, it was the eruption of Unzen. And yeah, both, it was the Maurice and Katja Craft plus Harry Glickin, a USGS geologist, that died in that eruption because they just got too close and the pyroclastic flow went slightly different direction than they expected. And that was that. And, you know, it's really tough. You can't get out of the way of them. You know, one of the other famous ones was the eruption at Pelée in the West Indies. And there you had the whole city wiped out, 20,000 people dying. And the only survivor in the city was a guy who was in jail deep underneath the building. And he even got burned from the heat generated by this pyroclastic flow, even though he was in this like cement block underneath the city itself.
Wow. Well, let's talk about the Western United States and California specifically. We tend to think of when we talk about geologic hazards in California, you know, the first thing we think of is earthquakes, San Andreas Fault, or perhaps the Hayward Fault. But my understanding is that volcanic eruptions occur at about the same rate as large earthquakes do in California. Could you characterize, you know, what some of the volcanic hazards are in California briefly for us?
Yeah, I mean, probably the most famous of volcanoes in California are, of course, going to be Shasta and Lassen Peak, and then Chaos Crags right next door. That are part of the Cascade Range. And they're going to, you know, Lassen erupted a little over 100 years ago. And, you know, Shasta is definitely still a very potentially active volcano. So there are those volcanoes that have erupted recently. There's Medicine Lake up in Northern California that erupted in the last few thousand years. You look on the east side of the Sierras and you have the Long Valley Caldera and then the Mono and Inyo lava domes that go up into Mono Lake. And those, again, those formed in the last few thousand years. So those are fairly recent activity as volcanoes go. You know, you get near San Francisco and Clear Lake is a place that they extract, you know, they have geothermal energy there that's being produced, but it's an active volcanic area that has erupted in, you know, in geologically recent enough time that we like to keep an eye on it. And even down in Southern California, you get around the Salton Sea and you get to the buttes down there, and those are rhyolite domes. So explosive volcanic eruptions and lava flows that came from there. And then all across the desert in Southern California, you'll run into these little cinder cones that are formed again in the geologically recent past that could very well start have new eruptions, not from the same cinder cones, but you might have more basalt eruptions and lava flows out in the desert depending on how things work out. But yeah, California up and down has got a significant amount of volcanism, which is why California has its own volcano observatory, the California Volcano Observatory. To keep an eye on all this swath of volcanoes up and down the state.
Well, before we let you go, I was looking at your blog, and of course the World Cup's going on in Russia, and I saw you have something called the Geologic World Cup on your blog.
Yeah, so you know my mother is Colombian, so I'm a big soccer fan because of that, and I like to combine my interests. So This year, we're having a geologic World Cup where I take the teams that qualified for the real World Cup and pit them against each other in the same way that the World Cup is going right now in these different groups. And the readers can vote on which countries they think have the most interesting geology. So I've picked out some interesting tidbits and some pictures, and people can go in and vote for them. I did this for the last World Cup, but it was only volcanoes. This time I've expanded it to include all of the geology, so that gives some countries that might not ever have a chance in a volcano World Cup, because they don't have any active volcanoes, a better chance of moving along. So it's kind of fun just to think about how certain countries have more geologic features that we don't know about, just because they're not, you know, whatever, the Grand Canyon or Kilauea or things like that are more prominent in popular culture.
Could you give us an example of one you maybe featured recently?
I mean, probably the biggest, when I came into this, I really did not know a lot about the geology of sort of the Balkan states. And there's a number of them in there. There's Serbia Serbia and Croatia. And these countries, I didn't realize had as complicated of geology as they do. So like, you know, Serbia has an area that is made of its landscapes that have carved down through andesite flows and these giant volcanic tuff deposits that are old, but they represent a time when there were active volcanoes in Serbia millions of years ago. So I thought that was, you know, these are one of these things that I just had no idea that they had this sort of history in Serbia. So those are the sorts of countries that I just, having not ever been there and then not having the sort of geology that I tend to work on, I hadn't really thought too much about what you find there. But there tends to be interesting geology almost anywhere you can go.
Sounds like a lot of fun. And, you know, if somebody out there has a favorite team that goes down in defeat, you could always go visit that country's geologic features and root for them.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Eric Clementi, it's been a lot of fun talking to you about volcanoes, and we've learned a lot in our Volcanoes 101 show here. I appreciate your time and your interest in earth science. It's very fascinating.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure.
Thanks to our guest, Eric Clementi, professor of geosciences at Denison University. Check out his blog, Rocky Planet, on the Discover Magazine website. Well, Nolan, I think we should go out with a song about volcanoes by the great prog band Genesis from 1976. It's called Dance on a Volcano, and it features Phil Collins on drums and vocals. Very underrated drummer, Phil. Everyone knows him for them Disney songs. Steve Hackett shredding on guitar, Tony Banks plinking the keys, and Mike Rutherford on bass guitar. Mind you, Mike's a fine bass player, almost in the same league as Derek Smalls of Spinal Tap. But truly, you can't compare Genesis to the Tap, because by definition, the ST is incomparable, if you know what I mean. Well, anyway, enjoy the tune and mind the song when it says that the lover's the lover who'll lick your boots away.
are green, the crosses are blue. Your friends didn't make it through. Out of the night and out of the dark, into the fire and into the fight. Well, that's the way the heroes go. Ho, ho, ho. Through a crack in Mother Earth, blazing hot, the molten rock spills out over the land. And the love is the lover who licks your boots away.
Thank you for listening. If you want to share this program or listen to past episodes, you can do that on mynspr.org, or better yet, subscribe to Blue Dot on NPR Podcasts. Follow us on Twitter at NSPR News and me at Dave Shlom. Our theme music is by Matt Schultz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the man on the board, Nolan Ford. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.